Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Sublimely Gothic, the podcast devoted only to the most sordid and macabre tales ever penned to paper. Here you shall explore the darkest jewels of literature with gothic enthusiasts Amy and Jess. Enter this realm at your own risk, for the night is dark and full of terrors. Welcome to the show, everyone. This is a special bonus episode of Sublimely Gothic. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we're going to discuss a gothic fairy tale that was just released last month, The Puppet Master's Apprentice. I thought this novel would be perfect to follow our season premiere with Frankenstein because the book itself was actually marketed as a sort of hybrid of Frankenstein and Pinocchio. And joining us this evening is a very special guest. Everyone, please welcome the author herself of The Puppet Master's Apprentice, Lisa Desaulm. Thank you so much for joining us, Lisa.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for having me, Amy and Jess. This is my first podcast ever, and I get to talk about my first published book. So this is incredible. Thank you so much for having me.
We're glad you're here. Your book is I think, you know, in our prep, I said it was a very wonderful escape from reality right now. So I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. That's great to hear.
So I think, you know, because of this, we're in a very special position of we have the writer here to actually discuss the book in of itself. So I think we wanted to start with a few just questions in general about the book and your process writing it. So I think I know you've been doing a few like Instagram live interviews with like other authors and stuff like that. So I'm sure you've gotten this question before, but basically how did the idea for this book pop into your head? Because I was thinking about it because there are plenty of fairy tale renditions out there. That's been really hot in both prose and poetry within the last decade, but few have gone into the direction of Pinocchio of all things. They tend to go for the princess fairy tales and then the feminist reimagining of those stories. So just what started this project and why Pinocchio? I'm intrigued.
Sure. I love to talk about that. So I actually had just finished drafting another fairy tale retelling, a Sleeping Beauty retelling. And while I was querying for that project, trying to get that published, I had had such fun doing that. And I just thought, I want to do another fairy tale retelling. What can I do? And I know in order to sell a fairy tale retelling these days, you need to really come at something from a unique angle or do a retelling that hasn't been done very often. And so I was literally just brainstorming in my journal. I don't write any of my books by hand, but I do daily doodling and journaling of ideas, and I'm jotting down character notes. And so I was just brainstorming in my notebook and literally going through a bunch of Grimm's fairy tales and just fairy tale ideas. And I had watched the Disney classic animated film of Pinocchio not long before with my daughters. And after watching that, I was kind of unsatisfied. And I feel like there's so much more to this story that could be explored. And so I just started brainstorming that in my notebook. And as I was jotting down ideas, the question came to me, what if the Pinocchio character was a girl made from wood instead of a boy? And it was like, as soon as I had that idea, it just hooked me. And I couldn't stop brainstorming until I had fleshed out a story there. And so that's really what drew me in to wanting to do a Pinocchio retelling. And I do think it's kind of unique. I'm not aware of many other Pinocchio retellings, at least not in like young adult fiction. So I knew I kind of had a unique angle on the story. I just began brainstorming and plotting that and fleshing that out. And I was just really excited about it. And I kind of have my own personal barometer is when I can't stop thinking about a story idea and it just won't let me go, I kind of know that's the next thing I'm supposed to work on. And that's how it was with this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Again, because I was just, you know, as I said, you know, the fairy tale retelling is so popular and with good reason. And I think the most popular fairy tale retelling is Beauty and the Beast. And I just finished A Court of Wings and Ruins, which is the ultimate Beauty and the Beast retelling. And yes. So when I heard about Pinocchio, I'm like, oh, I haven't seen a rendition of Pinocchio yet. That's so cool. And the fact that it's super dark. And I'm like, awesome. Yeah.
That's so great. Yeah, and I was really able to draw a lot from my own experiences to write the book in terms of the setting and the characters. I spent my high school years living in Germany, and I was really privileged to do that and to be able to travel a lot in Europe. So there's just so many beautiful castles and ruins and incredible villages. And all of that experience in my high school years really kind of informed and inspired the whole setting for this book. So once I kind of latched onto the story idea, I just felt like I already had this sort of treasure trove of creative world building at the ready from having had that experience.
I think
that's the, yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead, Jess.
I was going to say, I think you can really tell that through the novel, like to get, you know, I'm not surprised you mentioned you had traveled to Germany, because that's kind of, I had a very particular setting in my head. And that, I mean, that's also a testament to your writing. So something that you mentioned was that, you know, I think Pinocchio, and we talked about the story of Pinocchio being one of the less like tapped fairy tales for reimagining, which, you know, I guess I would probably not have thought about Pinocchio. I noticed that you, when I was reading the inside cover, that kind of your acknowledgments and about the author, that you in your day life have experience with art direction. So
yeah.
I was wondering if you had any experience with puppet making, because I feel like when I was reading that, I was like, you sure know there's a lot about puppet making in here that I would have no idea unless I like just researched and so. I don't know if that's something you want to talk about and really the story.
Sure. So I don't have any personal experience in woodworking or puppet making, but I kind of feel like I have my parents to thank for some of the inspiration there. My mom is actually a ventriloquist. And so she, in her childhood, my grandparents had a ventriloquist dummy made for her. And so part of my childhood was like seeing this ventriloquist dummy that my mom had. He was built, custom built for their family, and he looked like my uncle, her brother. And so as a kid, I was just always fascinated by her doing his voice. And he was, you know, equal parts kind of creepy and fascinating to me as a child. And then my dad is an amazing woodworker. He can build anything. He can carve anything. He's just incredible. And so I had got to grow up helping him in his workshop and watching him. But yeah, I personally don't have any experience with woodworking other than what I've just gotten to do with my dad a little bit. So a lot of the inspiration for the artisanship and the craftsmanship that you see described in the book comes from just kind of my own sort of observation and watching artisans at work. And again, living in Europe, like every little village that you travel to, you know, there's actual real blacksmiths and there's people blowing glass and making incredible, the grandfather clocks and timepieces. And so I've just always had such a fascination and an appreciation for everything that people make by hand. And so now as an art director, I feel like I do so much digitally. And I'm often feeling like, oh, I just miss painting by hand and doing things by hand. I don't do that enough these days. So really this book and the descriptions and the setting is just kind of like my own personal love letter or homage, if you will, to all the people that make beautiful things by hand, because I don't do nearly enough by hand as I would like.
Yeah, you can definitely see that in the book with the guild and all the artisans that are a part of that guild, with Emmett and, you know, with the clockmaker and all of those things. It's not just about the puppet master, like the whole community definitely emulating that dramatic village feel of all those artisans coming together and just living their lives.
Yeah. Yeah, that I really tried to include that there with the Makers Guild and that kind of cast of secondary characters. I feel like I just wanted to show sort of my appreciation for what I feel like they bring to life, you know, in the village and in the community life. And people are just creating beautiful, amazing things. So I'm just always in awe of that.
Yeah, I really liked that scene of the Makers Guild. I think you can kind of tell your affection for like you said, artistry and artistry. I don't know. I like that scene, and I think your affection for that type in Thank those you. Characters.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny that, again, you get this, you grew up and, you know, spent some time in Germany, which is just so ironic because, you know, Frankenstein takes place, you yes. know, in Germany and Austria. But I remember you saying in our early correspondence that it actually was not your intention to write a gothic novel, but that just in the way that the story flowed, you just sort of ended mm-hmm. up there. So talk about that journey.
Yeah. So it was kind of a surprise to me because my literary agent and several other people made similar comments after reading the book. And they were like, oh, I love the gothic tones to this. And full disclosure, I had to go and Google, like, what makes something a gothic novel? Because I did not set out to write a gothic novel, but it just sort of turns out that the right setting and the right tone and some of the creepy things I wanted to include are definitely gothic elements. So I've had to sort of reverse educate myself a little bit about gothic literature. After the fact, because it was kind of a surprise to me. But some of my influences there, besides just my own experience being in Germany, and I've seen, you know, just incredible toy maker shops and been through like dollhouse museums and torture museums. They've got all kinds of crazy stuff, amazing stuff in Europe. So that definitely inspired and informed my writing. And again, full disclosure, I actually have not read the complete work of Mary Wollstonecraft of Frankenstein. I've started it, but I've never read the complete novel. So the themes from Frankenstein that I was actually drawing upon sort of unconsciously, and I didn't realize till after the fact, were actually due to the fact that I was watching the TV show Penny Dreadful during yes. the drafting of this. And so that obviously has a ton of gothic themes, and that's kind of a combination of a bunch of different stories from literature all brought together. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that at all.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. I tried getting into it. I'm sure it's a brilliant TV show. It has Sean Bean, one of my favorite actors. It was just personally yeah. too gory for me. So, but yeah, Jess, you've watched
it. It is very much so. And, you know, for me personally, some of the storylines I didn't love, but in particular, the Victor Frankenstein storyline, I was just so drawn to it. And the writers of that show just did a beautiful job, I feel like, describing the relationship that Victor Frankenstein has with his creatures and the pain that the creature feels and the struggle to want to become human and what does that mean. It was just gorgeous. And so I was watching that sort of during the drafting of it, and I felt like that ended up kind of coming through in my writing, where I kind of talk about that struggle. What does it mean for, you know, something that we make to become human, and for Pirouette, my main character, to feel fully human? And so that definitely inspired that as well. But yeah, I didn't really set out to write a gothic novel, but it turns out I sort of have. So that's been actually kind of a fun surprise. And, you know, looking back at it, I think I have some elements in there, you know, the sort of mysterious Wolfspire Hall, and the Margrave and his son are sort of mysterious, sort of gothic characters. And I also included a little sort of homage to the Whipping Boy story, which is another sort of classic yes. tale. And so that was something, as a child, that story always sort of fascinated and horrified me. And so I couldn't help but sort of tuck that in there as well. So yeah, it's kind of cool to look back at it and see that it has a lot of gothic elements to it, even though I didn't intend that when I first set out to write it.
Lisa, the mention of the Whipping Boy was really interesting to me, because one of my my best friend, that's like he really loves that story, and yeah. he's like, I'll never see a depiction of that. I know that. And then when I was reading the book, I was like, oh my gosh, I've never seen it. It's such a book that I think, you know, I think I read it a long time ago when I was a kid, that sticks with you, that I was yeah. kind of surprised that I've never seen that mentioned. But anyway, so, okay, I feel a little justified that I was like, I did. And I was like, maybe, I don't know. So that was cool.
Yep.
So yeah, I was just really fascinated by, again, your serendipitous arrival at Gothic literature, just because I feel like in going through this podcast, Jess and I have, you know, discussed probably in previous episodes that, you know, Gothic literature, especially when it was being published in the 18th, 19th century, was considered trashy, like melodramatic. And so, you know, some people approach Gothic literature with a certain level of, you know, the over the top, the hyper theatricality or the melodrama. And so that there's a sort of artificialness to it. But I think just the fact that something is dark, it doesn't mean that it's not natural. And I think the fact that you came to all these elements of Gothic literature on your own just shows that, you know, Gothic elements are just as relevant and have their own literary merit as any other facet of literature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think so much of young adult fiction is, now that I understand it a little bit better, is really influenced by a lot of elements in Gothic literature. I mean, the dark, the paranormal, you know, the magic side of things. That's just all over young adult fiction. And what's so cool, my literary agent let me know, she did her master's thesis on the impacts of Gothic literature in like current young adult fiction. And so it's like, no wonder she was drawn to this novel, because it just makes complete sense.
Ooh, I need to get her on the podcast too.
Yeah.
She's awesome.
All right then. Jess, did you have a question?
I did have a question. I was really curious about the location. I hope I'm saying this right. I said it as Tavia.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So I Googled the word, and the search that came up was a type of moth. So I was just like, I feel like that was, so is there, can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I wasn't actually choosing it for the meaning of the word. I was trying to find a German sounding word, sort of like Bavaria, or I think there's an actual place. Let me Google it really quickly. Batavia. I think Batavia is like another sort of town, city. So I actually pulled it from there, wanting a sort of German sounding place that would feel like it's a sort of German Black Forest type of village. So there isn't actually any special meaning to the name, but it's really cool that it actually means moth. One of the first books that I ever drafted, which is living in my Word document graveyard on my computer and will probably never see the light of day, was actually a whole fairy tale about moths and a whole like mythology I had developed about moths. So that's a super cool connection.
Well, and I read that, and I had been reading a book called Sawkill Girls. And of the things that happens is she, the moths talk to her. So again, Sawkill Girls definitely has Gothic monsters like that. Mm-hmm. And it's a young literature book. So I think it's a specific type of moth.
That's cool.
I thought that was a really interesting choice for your location. And didn't really look into that moth much more than that, but I was like, there's gotta be this. So that's really interesting. Thanks for answering.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, for character names and place names and the setting, I kind of just tried to pull from German words or German and French names. Even though the original Pinocchio tale is Italian, I was kind of trying to pull more from German and French words and names. So that just happened to feel right. And for my main character, who is Pirouette, I wanted to do a name that still felt like it had a tie to Pinocchio by starting with a P, but I didn't want it to be so obvious. Same thing with Gephardt, her father. I wanted to sort of give a nod to Geppetto, but have it be a more German-sounding name. So that's kind of how I landed on some of my names. And I just often play around until something sounds right or feels right.
And Amy, if I may, I have one more question about Pinocchio, and I think that's a great way to build a character. I feel like I do a little bit of writing, and I love that you called it the Word document graveyard, because I think I have the beginnings of and like scenes of stories living there. And then you try, you know, to get that character name, because I think once you have it, you're like, and then I can see him or her, and you know, whatever.
Yes.
So with Pinocchio, because, you know, much like a lot of fairy tales we know Disney-fied, mm-hmm. they're a lot you know, they're sanitized for mm-hmm. for us. I feel like every time I get on this podcast, I have to tell people how old I am. I'm 37. So okay. I grew up with a lot of, you know, watching a lot of Disney movies. And then sure. to my horror, you know, years later, finding out that maybe that Disney story wasn't so nice. So I haven't read Pinocchio, the original story, or, you know, it, can you talk a little bit about Pinocchio from, you know, it, the origin? Like, I know it's a, you mentioned the, took place in Italy, but I don't know much more beyond like what I saw in the Disney movie. I think part of it scared me, like the Pinocchio.
Oh yeah,
that scared me.
Yeah, I
know,
think
the donkey transformation scene.
Yes, yes, yes. The donkey scene is very scary.
Yes.
Yeah. So Pinocchio is originally an Italian fairy tale. It was written by Carlo Collodi. I think if that pronounced his name correctly. And I actually, my husband and I went on a trip to Florence, and I think we got to see like the special bridge where it, this like part where the writer lived, and they have, you know, Pinocchio toys kind of all over Florence. And so Pinocchio and Geppetto, Pinocchio was carved by Geppetto, is in a Tuscan village. And so he was created as a wooden puppet. I'm kind of just looking on Wikipedia right now to help me summarize, but he dreams of becoming a real boy. And so he struggles with lying. And I'm not sure if the ending of the actual Pinocchio tale is much different than the Disney tale. His nose grows, so there's visible consequences for him lying. My real inspiration was kind of seeing the Disney classic and feeling like there's just some creepy elements here that are mm-hmm. interesting, but just feeling like I just want to know like more. And once I sort of latched on to that idea of what if it was a girl made from wood, I just felt like I could identify with that character so much more. And it just made me ask a bunch of questions, like what would it feel like for her having been made of wood and then brought to life? Would she have had this other life before her human life? And how does that influence her? And then, you know, we all know Pinocchio's nose grows when he lies. And I didn't really want to translate that into my story in any way. So I tried to find, without giving away too much, the book does have my main character, Pirouette, have these visible and painful consequences for telling lies. But I tried to do it and approach it in a different way than the traditional tale does. So I kind of use the initial story really just as a springboard and didn't rely on it wholly to tell my version. But yeah, that's definitely where it comes from.
Thank you.
Yeah. So again, after your experience or accidental foray into Gothic literature, do you think you'll want to continue this sort of, I know you mentioned, you know, you had also written a Beauty and the Beast, or not Beauty and the Beast, Sleeping Beauty mm-hmm. retelling. Do you tend to stay in this direction of darker toned fairy tale retellings, or what other projects do you think are in store for you?
I feel like right now I'm just loving fairy tale retellings and trying to find creative and unique ways that I can do that. I feel like fairy tales always have dark elements to them. And so I feel like there's just all different interesting ones that you can kind of explore. And when you do read like a lot of the Grimm's fairy tales, for example, it's
super morbid.
Yeah, they're sort of dark, they're morbid, they're very short, and it's like, and then he goes home and then he dies. Or so I think there's just a lot of room to play there as a writer and to explore, you know, why are the villains in these tales the way that they are, and to explore some of the magical things that happen and the magical characters. And so, yeah, I definitely see myself staying with young adult fairy tale retellings for the time being. The one I'm drafting right now is sort of a Boy Who Cried Wolf / Red Riding Hood tale Ooh. That I'm trying to work on. So we'll see how that goes, but it's a
and
lot of
that story
fun.
Should have had Wolf Spire Hall, because I'm just going to say Wolf Spire is a dope name. I was so pleased by that. By that, that manor house.
And kind of spider. Well, I know it's spire, but it's kind of like a spider, and I hate spiders.
Oh,
so, yeah.
Yeah,
it was a good combo. It was a, yeah, great name.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm glad to hear that you'll stay with fairy tale reimaginings. Like, for me as a reader, as you see, I bought your book. I just finished Court of Thorns and roses, I love, you know, reading it. I just know myself as a writer, I am too scared to try to do that because, again, it's just so saturated. Like, if I do want to do retellings, I want to, like, go a retelling of, like, maybe some classic novel of the 18th or 19th century, like, not going all the way back to fairy tales. But, yeah.
Yeah. I know it's definitely challenging to try to find those unique angles or unique twists on a story. And it's easy to think, oh, this story's been told so many times. But, you know, in some ways you think, well, it hasn't been told using my voice yet. Right. Or if you feel like you have a really unique angle on something, I say go for it.
Yeah. Yeah. My sister got me hooked on the TV show Once Upon a Time. So.
Oh yeah. That's a good one.
Alrighty then, and let's see, I think I just had one more question. Basically, what do you hope your readers take away from The Puppet Master's Apprentice?
That is a great question. I hope that readers are just left with a sense of knowing, like I think my main character is left with a sense of knowing that you can make beautiful things in the world, and you are strong, and you are capable. It doesn't matter, you know, whether you're 14 or you're 84, you can master something, you can master a craft, you can become really great at something. And so I just want people to be left with sort of a sense of like of their own ability and just a reminder that they can make beautiful things.
And they may not have to do the same thing as their parents, like Bran, who is in the Taylor's family, but he wants to work with Emmett as a sort of clockmaker.
That's right. Yep. I think we're all just gifted in so many different ways. And I think whatever you're interested in, you know, whether it's art or music or mechanical things or technology, I think you should pursue those things and sort of just give yourself time and give yourself a chance because you just don't know what you're capable of till you really try.
Mm-hmm. All right, then. Well, thank you so much for indulging our questions. And I think now we'll move on to the free-flowing discussion of the book. And for all listeners, spoiler warning, we are going to be going into the entirety of the book and we will be analyzing elements that do contain spoilers. So if you don't want to be spoiled, you need to stop listening right now.
I'm so glad you said that because I feel like I almost spoiled something earlier. So I was like, oh, no.
Anyway, well, it's hard for me too in interviews. I have to stop and think, wait, Lisa, no spoilers. Right. That's good to just give people a heads up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Jess, do you want to start the discussion? Because you just finished it. So it's so much fresher in your mind. The only thing I want to point out is, of course, the very beginning where we get like the sort of origin story of Pirouette and the fact that it's a blue moon. Mm-hmm. And again, I just love your use of the blue moon because I myself am a pagan. And so I do following the lunar cycles is a part of my religious practice. And I don't think it was an accident that your publisher published it in October of this year because this Halloween, it was not just a full moon, but a full blue moon.
That was so incredible to me, just the timing of that. I think it was no accident either. And, you know, I included that element in the story actually as a nod to the blue fairy in the Disney animated version. So that's kind of where that came from. But I wanted something magical like that and special because it's so rare.
Because although in your book, the blue moon only comes like once every 7 years.
Yep.
Yeah, because technically, you know, we get the term once in a blue moon because there are 13 full moons in a calendar year, but only 12 months, which means that there's usually one month that has two full moons. And the second kind of abnormal full moon in that month is called the blue moon. And so we're not going to have another full moon on Halloween until 2039. And I don't think we're going to have another full blue moon Halloween until like 2077.
That's so crazy. It's incredible.
Yeah, but that was just, I wanted to start off with, I'm just, as a practicing pagan, I really appreciate the blue moon reference.
Very cool.
Yeah, I think, you know, I knew that about Amy and I have done moon ritual for the new moon, the full moon. So kind of reinforcing the magic of the new moon that I think a lot of people are kind of acknowledging. What's a beautiful full moon has its, you know, its own magic no matter what in the sky. Just kind of looking at it, I know a lot of people take it to appreciate that. So I thought that was wonderful. It's really hard for me not to just kind of like dive into the story and ask the questions I want to ask and not go in a linear fashion.
We don't have to go in a linear fashion. Okay. If you don't want to, I just have a few like bullet points that I have, and it'll bounce back and forth.
Okay. Well, cool. Then I'm going to ask my question that I wanted to ask earlier, and you kind of touched on it, Lisa. Was about the Pinocchio's nose grows when he lies.
Yes.
And Pirouette has splinters that are puncture various parts of her body, which I've talked about this before. I don't like body horror. Like, that's just not my cup of tea, but I do appreciate something graphic like that to kind of talk about a painful, a repercussion for doing something. So this was very, the penalty for lying for people was less humiliation, you know, less the nose growing. I mean, I do experience a couple times where somebody sees the splinter and that, but it was definitely more physical pain for her. So can you talk a little bit about the decision to kind of like reimagine the nose growing into splinters, which I thought was really, really cool and a very cool, I can't think of a better word right now, modern way to change that story.
A newer manifestation of the lying. Of the lying trope.
Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. So I sort of stumbled on that as I was just brainstorming. I knew that I wanted her to still have consequences for lying. I knew I wanted that to be something that she wrestles with. It's kind of like the last remnants of her past. And so she obviously wants to hide it because the fact that she was even made is kind of against the law. Such elemental magical spells are forbidden in the place where she lives. So she kind of has to hide that about herself. And so as I was brainstorming, it was just really me kind of trying to figure out what could it be, you know, what sort of consequence could she have that would tie to her origins as a tree and having been made from wood that would make sense. And so I just stumbled on the idea of splinters, and I've had, as a kid, I used to run around barefoot all the time. I've had horrible splinters in my feet, and like my mom and dad have had to try to take them out at home. And so I've had some traumatic experiences there. So that kind of fed into that a little bit. And then as a kid, I also used to get really horrible cold sores, just all over my face. And, you know, there's just nothing as awesome as like having to go to middle school with giant cold sores all over your face and like having to suffer through that. And not only do you feel like they make you look ugly, but they're painful. And so I kind of just drew on my own experiences to write what I imagined that would be like for her. And the addition of it happening when she lies and then her constantly, that internal struggle she feels with like, am I lying out loud? Am I telling the truth? You know, sometimes I think we tell lies to protect ourselves or to protect other people. And so there's just a lot she has to wrestle through. And I think it makes it pretty interesting. At least I hope it does to read her struggle there.
No, I think I think that was, very interesting. And when reading it, when she got a splinter, I was like, this is the nose. And this is such a cool way to do that. So,
No, I was the same way when I realized that not only she wouldn't, but we're gonna go all out with the lying stuff, that we're keeping that, but it's in a much cooler way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then also like going on, you know, her, you know, origins as a tree and everything. I really liked the talking trees, and I really liked how, like, you know, some fantasy stories are like, if you burn down a tree or if you like cut down a tree, it's like, the tree is screaming, I'm dying, I'm dying. But I liked that, you know, just by the nature of Pirouette's creation, that it's not so much as a death as a sort of like, again, just transitioning of a different type of body. And so that cutting down the trees isn't necessarily bad, and she still has the connection with the trees and all of that. You know, I just thought that was a really nice touch.
Cool. Thank you. Thanks for picking up on all of that.
Yeah. Was there any, because you did make a point to talk about the specific types of trees, you know, and how, I wrote them down. Prima. you know, was carved out of a very specific type of wood. Was there additional symbolism in that choice, like oak versus linden? Sorry.
Linden. Yeah. So I was just doing some research, thanks to Google and Wikipedia, and like researching what do puppet makers traditionally make, you know, carve their wooden marionettes out of. And linden was one of the woods that was often used. So that's why I chose that, like particularly for Prima. And then for the wooden soldiers that Pirouette and her father have to create, I invented a type of tree called halsa. Mm-hmm. And I based it off the idea of balsam wood, which is, you know, tree that grows and they're very light, but I think they grow to be like big, big normal oak tree type size. But the wood itself is very light and easily carvable, almost like more like styrofoam than something like hard oak would be. So I kind of used a little creative artistic license there to create a type of wood that Pirouette and her father could use to carve these big creatures. Because I think if you would make big life-size wooden soldiers out of like oak, for example, they'd just be so heavy. It'd be like trying to lift your kitchen table.
Right. Yeah.
So I just took a little creative license there. And so some of it I invented and then some of it was just based on my research.
Nice. One theme that I kind of honed in on in this book was the theme of workaholism.
Sorry. I feel like I know something about that and I'm trying to remedy.
Yeah, no, and I felt like it was a timely, you know, I don't think it's, you know, unreasonable that I honed in on that at that particular time, because basically Pierrot's father is working himself to death, literally trying to get all this stuff done. And again, the balance of, you know, these are really, you know, to have the Margrave as his client who wants to, you know, keep him in, you know, business, he should be grateful for that. But at the same time, you know, the Margrave and all his little minions are being so demanding that that Pierrot's father just can't keep up. And it just made me think of, again, I'm sure Jess has felt these sentiments as well, as, you know, certainly during this, you know, global pandemic, there are a lot of people who are currently unemployed or underemployed, but even for those whose maybe direct day jobs haven't been affected, they're, you know, experiencing those sort of like demands from supervisors as everyone navigates new workplace terrains, like whether it's remotely or any other changes. And so not, you know, just because, you know, you shouldn't have the mentality of you should just be grateful that you have a job, you know, in light of the pandemic. It's like, yes, that's true, but that doesn't give you an excuse to work me to death.
Right. Right. I think that sort of work-life balance is something that I struggle with. We probably all struggle with it to a certain degree. And I think for people who are artisans or who own their own business, you know, your work is just so often your life and it's your passion, but at the same time, it's your job and it's the way that you eat. And so when I was imagining like the Makers Guild and all these characters, that's what I was really picturing is, you know, folks who their work is their livelihood and their life and they live where they work and they're just kind of consumed by it all the time. And then with the Margrave adding these big commissions to Gephardt and Pirouette, you know, they need to do that to eat, but it just kind of consumes them to an unhealthy degree, probably. So
Amy, I'm so glad you pointed that out, because I said I liked the Makers Guild scene when they all kind of got together and had a drink and water, because my first thought and kind of like, you know, recognizing a problem situation was I thought, wow, she has so much work to do. What is she doing leaving? And then I thought, I'm the one with the issue here, not her. So I just wanted to make sure.
That makes me laugh. You're so right. She should get back home. She's got lots to do.
Right. And then I realized that's a very, and then I had to take a step back and go, maybe I need to think about life a little.
The Europeans often have a good approach to that where they, you know, they're done with work every day by 4 and they take really healthy holidays. And so in America, at least, we definitely have a very workaholic culture that's hard to escape that. So,
Let's see. What else? What point was I going to make? I think one thing I was thinking about, like in the Frankenstein episode, you know, we talked about, okay, Frankenstein was able to like bring life to this creature, but what is life? Does life entail like certain cognitive abilities or language or Is it purely just breathing and being a vegetable? So in your mind, like, how do you feel Pirouette developed her personality, like, after she was created?
That's a great question. I think that's a question still that people wrestle with, like, in movies and TV, you know, thinking about, like, artificial intelligence and with robots, what makes something human? And so I think the same sort of translates to Pirouette's story, having been made from wood and being a puppet. What is it that makes her human? And I don't know if I fully answered that in the book or, you know, answered it the best way, but I felt like I think she spent the first couple years of her life, I think I mentioned, sort of just observing and watching and listening and not talking much, partially because she's afraid if she gets caught in a lie that her splinters will give her away. And then partially because I think the customs of humanity just seem so new to her. So I think she learns to become human by observation and watching. And I think that in the end, it's her connection to her family and her friends, that she sort of has this found family, this tribe that she feels really connected to, that she belongs to, that makes her feel fully human. And her relationship with Bran, the love that she has for him, and wanting to imagine a future with him, but she's kind of afraid because she doesn't know what that would be like for her because of her origins. So she kind of wrestles through all of that. And yeah, I don't know if I answer it completely, but I think it's really her sense of community and family and the love that she has. And then she wrestles with those things again when she becomes a maker, a master, and creates both the Saboteur and Prima. Because then I think with them, she has more of a, almost like a motherly sort of inventor and creation sort of relationship. And she cares about them and wonders, you know, what does her humanity mean for them as well? I don't know if I answered that the best way, but
I think kind of something, a deviation from the Gothic, which I appreciated because this is one of the things that, like, kind of gets under my skin when I read Gothic literature. Like, I don't like kind of undermining and the family kind of undercutting things that we often see in Gothic literature. I think the past two books that we just read, Northanger Abbey and The Mysteries of Udolpho, you know, somebody's trying to undermine or undercut somebody to get their way or whatever. And you know, maybe part of it that is just life sometimes. But the camaraderie that was depicted in this novel with the makers when she's, you know, working on Prima and she's like, you know, would be really great are these glass eyes. I thought that was really, to me, that was really refreshing to read in a Gothic book with Gothic elements, because so often when you're reading Gothic literature, it just kind of starts dark and gets darker and darker and darker. So that was a little glint of light that I
appreciate. Especially for the old school Gothic literature that we've been reading, because so much of it is a commentary on, like, social hierarchies and why those are bad. Mm. But, you know, in this one, we got to see a nice, healthy community, you know, ecosystem, if you will.
It was refreshing from all the other, you know, what me. Amy
That's made. Great.
Yeah. All right, then. So let's see. What other notes do I have? I was so sad when Emmett died.
Oh, I know. Me too.
Like, oh, she's getting me so invested in him, and she's going to kill him, isn't she? And I'm like, yep. Why you got to do me like that?
Oh, I'm so sorry. I know. I loved him too. And I had one or two scenes actually in the clock shop that I think in later revisions ended up getting cut for pacing reasons. But I just love Emmett and his mother. I love the whole clock shop. I love describing it. So yeah, he was a great character and really fun to write. And I'm sad. I'm sad that he's gone too.
Yeah, well, I think the minute that, you know, there was this rumor that he, or not so much rumor, it's basically common knowledge at this point that he is the bastard son of the Margrave. And I'm just like, oh, well, he's going to get knocked off.
Oh, very perceptive.
I had the same reaction to the Saboteur. I I kind of really grew to like her a lot. So having her demise was a bummer, but you got me there because I did not expect Pyrrho to present Laszlo with a female assassin. Mm-hmm. And then I sat there and I was like, am I sexist? Like, so basically this book made me ask a lot of questions about myself, but I really thought that I just want, now I like a saboteur in just, a little cool wood carving. That was a pretty cool.
Yeah. I was so disappointed when she went up in flames with the house, which another element of Gothic literature, the manor or castle always burns down.
Yes, yes, it does. You nailed that. Yes.
Pemberley, or not Pemberley. Oh my God, I've been reading too much Jane Austen. Manderley and Rebecca burns down. Angelfield and 13th Tale burns down. Yes. The manor and Silent Companions burns down.
There's something's always got to burn, it feels like, at the end.
I know. Well, and with this story in particular, with all the puppets, it's like, it just made sense. I was like, I need to have some sort of climax at the end where things go very, very badly for the new Margrave. And so with his collection being wooden, it just made sense to me that he would be like deathly afraid of fire. And so that had to be the the thing that took it all down in the end.
Yeah. So yeah, when reading this, we get, we slowly get exposed to Laszlo, the new Margrave, and basically he's this sickly child. And sometimes I was half debating, okay, is she going to pull a secret plot twist where maybe he's a pain in the butt and he's a not very nice person, but maybe he's not the primary villain. But then that ended up being the case. But I really liked that he was kind of a case study of someone who isn't allowed to properly socialize.
Yeah.
And so that he has this pathological obsession with the puppets where he's equating the puppets with friends. Go ahead.
Oh yeah. I was just going to say, you're picking up exactly on what I was trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause it reminded me a lot of The Silent Companions by Laura Purcell. And while the evil things that come to life are not puppets, there are these wooden figurines from Amsterdam, but they're actually controlled by a child who was mute. And again, the idea that these are her friends, real people aren't her friends because she's so sociopathic she cannot make human connection.
Yeah. Yeah, he was really fun for me to write because I was just trying to sort of explore the psychology of what would it be like if you were in his shoes and you're sort of a sickly child and you're kept isolated so much of your life and you weren't allowed to have other kids around. And you liked puppets. And so that was his one sort of joy. And he loved his collection and amassing this collection. And so obviously as he grew, the importance of the puppets in his life, I imagine, grew as well. And so he kind of built his own sort of guild of friends there with his creations, his puppets. And then when he sort of stumbled on the idea of the magic, finding a magic spell that might bring him to life, that kind of opened up a whole new world to him. So he was very fun to write.
Yeah. And it's not just his specific, hobby manifestation was the puppets, but it's very true that not just any sickly, but a lot of royals feel trapped in that way because, my husband is Persian. So I know a great deal of Persian history and especially the modern history of, the Shah that was deposed. When the Shah was growing up, his childhood was so boring because, he had all these attendants where if he got hurt or something, even though he wasn't necessarily sickly or or had anything wrong with him, just the fact that all these attendants, if anything happens to him, it's going to be our heads on the chopping block. So yeah. I feel like a lot of children of parents in high positions of power do go through that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would imagine it's really isolating and they don't get to just have a normal childhood with friends or get to play the way that other kids do. So yeah, that definitely has to affect you for sure.
I'm just curious in a bit of world building, just, the saboteur versus prima. So is it basically a different spell because, the saboteur is alive and animate and moving around, but she's still made of wood. Whereas Prima is able, because of the magic of the blue moon, is able to make the full transition into flesh and blood.
Yes. Yep. You're exactly right. That he finds a spell to sort of animate the puppets, but they're not really brought to life. They're kind of just under his spell, under his control. So he uses the saboteur in that way. And then he really wants, like, basically what Pirouette is. He wants a wife made to sort of his own specifications. And so that's when he commissions Piro to build, or forces her to build, Prima. And so she's different because she is basically brought to life using that same blue moon spell that created Piro.
And in the way that you've changed the gender with Pirouette, and then the person, the things she creates are also female, both in Saboteur and Prima, it kind of, you know, Frankenstein is called the modern Prometheus, but honestly, Frankenstein and these sort of stories make me more think of Pygmalion, you know, who is the guy who, you know, created, you know, the woman out of clay, and the gods had her come to life and, you know, just to be a sort of, you know, partner or mate, if you will.
Yeah. It's interesting, like, after reading about, like, Mary Shelley's original, I think that it sounds like Victor Frankenstein was more afraid of his creatures and what he had created. And I don't feel like my main character, Pirro, is really afraid of the creatures that she makes. She's kind of in awe, I think, of what she was able to create. And she loves them and she thinks they're beautiful and powerful. I think what she ends up feeling afraid of is almost like the loss of control, or has she created something that could harm someone else, or what happens when that creature is then out of her control. And so that's kind of where we wrestle with that idea of, has she made a monster or a masterpiece? And so she kind of goes back and forth on that throughout the book. But yeah, there's just some really interesting differences between the Saboteur character and the Prima character that were really fun to kind of write out and play out there.
And this is the part, Jess, where we go into comparing Pirouette's character and her sense of responsibility to Frankenstein.
I must have read my mind, because I when I was reading it, I think that you stated it very well, Lisa, wondering about Pirouette's kind of, what did I just create? You created something very beautiful, obviously, and that was intention, and in my opinion, the saboteur, how I imagine. But I think that I was trying to think about, like, who's the Victor Frankenstein in this story? And Piro, I could see part of that, but then I also thought about Laszlo as the, you know, kind of using his dark magic, where Victor is kind of gets to that point in his mind, like, I want to play God. And that's exactly what Laszlo is doing. He's kind of, you know, hidden away, trying to figure out the thing to these wooden creatures come to life. So I don't know, Amy, what were your thoughts? Because I kept reading, you know, when I was reading about your book, that, you know, Frankenstein and Pinocchio, and I thought, am I the one that's seeing Victor in a character that I'm not supposed to? Or, I mean, you know, sometimes, who knows? But I think I could see that Victor Frankenstein character split into both of those characters a little bit.
Yeah. For me personally, I didn't see Frankenstein so much in Laszlo. Laszlo is, again, I feel like, just, you know, the type of villain that, you know, sees an opportunity and exploits people with skills that he doesn't have to achieve his own. And, like, I was just constantly comparing Pirouette with Frankenstein, because, you know, all the things that Pirouette feels, the anxiety of, oh, like, my poor creation, my poor babies are out in the world and they're being controlled by someone else, that's terrible. She has a sense of responsibility, and even though, you know, she doesn't just throw her hands up in the air, it's like, oh, I can't do anything about it because Laszlo now has them all under his control, and, you know, even though I created them, it's not my problem anymore. Because that's basically what Frankenstein does, because he creates his monster, completely freaks out, and we talk extensively, as Jess put it so eloquently, what did he expect was going to happen?
Yeah.
But, yeah, so for me, like, Pirouette was all those sense of, you know, paternal sensibilities and the sense of responsibility and culpability. Those are all the things. It's a positive subversion of, you know, Frankenstein's abdication of responsibility.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I'm loving just hearing you guys talk about your perceptions of it, because it's just great to hear. It's so interesting.
Go ahead, Jess.
Oh, I, well, no, I was going to ask a completely different question. No, I imagine that's got to be a little weird too, Lisa, because, you know, I think when we talk about these books, I keep having to remind myself, and I think, again, this is a testament to work, that this book isn't older than it is, like, because it feels like an old story. And I think that's really nice and kind of hard to do sometimes. And that's a compliment. I was going to ask about the cover art, so I before I said that, because I really, I know, Amy, I don't mean to speak for you, but I remember us talking about that, and you said, like, look at this cover. It's just so awesome. So that's how I talk, not how Amy talks. But I think this was one that the cover really appealed to. I don't know, Lisa, if you wanted to talk a little bit about the artwork for the cover, because it is very visually commanding.
It is. It's, and I hear that from so many people, and that's just like such a joy to me, because I happen to be a graphic designer in my day job, and I didn't design this cover. The publisher designed it, but I obviously, as an author, you want a cover that's beautiful and that draws people in. So I feel really, really fortunate to have gotten this cover. So the publisher is the one who designed it, Page Street. Laura Benton from Page Street did the cover. And so I got to see it ahead of time, and I think I made like one or two minor, just, you know, gave them some feedback, but they just did a fabulous job. And I really feel like when you look at it, the blue moon and the puppet is just so central and draws you in right away. And then I feel like you start to notice the other details, like the foliage, and then you notice maybe the hands, the puppet master hands, sort of last of all. So it's just a beautiful cover. I'm so pleased with it.
Yeah, and especially like the ballerina sort of puppet in the full moon, like the making the allusion to Prima, because we get Prima originally as like Prima can also mean like one, like the first, like, you know, in a sense of creation, but also you give the foreshadowing of the actual original Prima ballerina puppet that Piero had as a sort of toy.
Right. Yep, exactly. And yeah, so that was just, you know, it's so hard as an artist, like, I often think very visually. And so, but for this cover, for this particular book, I didn't have any cover design in mind. So I was just really curious to see what they would come back with. And this is what they came up with. And I love the way it all came together and all the elements that are there.
Again, and as the pagan, I appreciate them going all out with the full blue moon.
Yes, it's beautiful.
All right, then. Well, I think we covered all my main bullet points, you know, within, like, plot-wise. Just one thing I wanted to mention is, you know, in extension to, you know, Piero's inability to lie, or at least inability to lie without consequences, like, I'm like, oh, that's a nice rendition. But then when through her, like, sort of budding relationship with Bran, we realize the greater implications of this hindrance and this this part of her, I don't know, curse is the right word, but just part of who she is. It's just, and it just shows that, you know, she would never make tell a malicious lie to manipulate Bran, or like she should be able to have a normal relationship, but just realizing the full implications of, oh, like he can't know anything, and like to even continue the facade of her past, even though that shouldn't have any effect on the relationship. Like she literally, you know, can only interact in society to a certain extent and can't have extremely close relationships because of way that she lies. And I didn't think about that originally when the splinter thing came out, and then her whole dilemma of getting close to a brand or not. And I'm just like, oh, like that's actually really deep. I didn't think about that before.
Yeah, I think it was interesting for me to kind of think through the morality of lying and telling the truth versus lies, and, you know, the lies that we sometimes tell to protect ourselves or protect other people. I think sometimes we lie with good intentions, but she can't even really do that. Her father has kind of lied and created this backstory for her to cover for her and protect her. But in the end, it kind of ends up not helping her at all, because she kind of can't keep up the farce at a certain point. So that was all really interesting stuff to kind of explore how that affected her.
Yeah, and the minute you had the name Bran for her love interest, I immediately went Three-Eyed Raven because I'm currently reading Game of Thrones.
Yes, I love that name. So that I can't lie that that was an inspirational source there.
I think I was one of the people in the world that really liked Bran. So I really appreciated it. I thought he was cool. I don't know.
That's great.
I like Bran up to this point. I'm reading.
Oh, I was going to say Bran in Game of Thrones. Let me be clear. I like Bran in the story, but.
Yeah, no, anyway. Three-Eyed Raven Bran.
Yes, that Bran.
Yeah, because I'm reading Game of Thrones specifically. There's another podcast that's going over several chapters at a time. So I'll read the chapters and then I'll listen to the podcast and read the chapters and listen to the podcast. And I just got to the part where Bran wakes up from his dream with the Three-Eyed Raven.
I've not read any of the books. I've just watched the TV show, but I love it.
Yeah. Alrighty then. Did you have any other specific points within the book you wanted to cover, Jess?
No, I think that I was trying to, when I read a gothic novel, I get a picture in my mind. And to me, where all the makers live, that was very sunny and, beautiful and whatever. And then when we go into the castle, the keep, which we haven't really talked about, I don't ever want to go there. It sounds like a very horrible place, but, if you wanted to talk a little bit about, you mentioned viewing some torture exhibits in your travels and things like that. And I've mentioned, again, I don't like body horror, but I did do a lot of research on medieval methods of execution. And you talked about burning a lot. And I thought that that was, obviously related to probably with the wood and things like that, but also very, European witch trials as well. So the keep and the burning and things like that, I'm assuming a little bit of your travels were the inspiration for the horrible, awful, smelly keep.
Yes. So the keep definitely part of it comes from just my imagination and trying to imagine what that would be like. And then part of it does come from just traveling and getting to see ruins. And you kind of realize, back then when they were building these massive structures, everything felt so narrow. And it may have been that people themselves were just quite a bit shorter or built differently than they are today with our modern diets and all our protein that we get. So everything just feels close and narrow. And it's still incredible, though, what they were able to construct by hand. So seeing castle ruins, that definitely influenced me. And then I forget if it's either in the city of Rotenburg or Heidelberg, but there's a really crazy torture museum that basically just showcases all kinds of medieval torture devices, everything from chastity belts to things that they would clamp on your tongue, they would put on women for their husband accusing them of telling them a lie, and they'd clamp this tongue clamp on them and parade them through the town square. So yeah, that all of that definitely feeds into my imagination. So it's really a combination of those things. And having read The Crucible and, I think the witch stuff and the burning, people used to do that to other humans. They would burn them alive. And I think that sounds like a horrible way to die. But it was definitely a sort of interesting backdrop or an interesting punishment and threat to kind of use in my story.
Yeah, well, I will say too that a lot of times some of those things can come across in novels and be a little too much to handle, I think, for a lot of people. And that it I don't think it was to that point. I'm thinking of, since we were talking about Game of Thrones, what's the guy that's horrible and I hate him and everybody hates him?
Oh, there's so many.
Ramsay Bolton.
Yes. Oh, he's
awful. We were
not
on that level. I know. Thank goodness. But there definitely were elements that in my mind. So
yeah,
so.
And I really wasn't trying to write horror either. This wasn't intended to be a super dark horror tale. I did really want to write a fairy tale that with some dark elements and some creepiness, but that ultimately leaves you with hope and, beauty and that kind of thing. So yeah, I didn't go super heavy.
Mission accomplished. I think that was great. This is, it had all the darkness that it needed to convey the points. And, again, we'll say it again. It was wonderful escapism to another place where, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, that's the goal.
Good. Good.
Alrighty then. So would you guys like to move on to the Gothometer?
Sure.
Yes.
Okay. So again, Lisa, this is how it works. We have five categories, basically. And you can also rank your rank as well. So we'll each go around, like, you know, giving a number for each category and explaining why we chose that number for that specific category.
Okay.
So, like, Jess and I will give our numbers. Then you can think about it and give your number as well for each category. And then we'll tally them up.
Sure.
Okay. So category number one, again, atmosphere and setting. And so, you know, again, classics with Gothic literature, are there moors, are there castles, you know, just the dark ambiance. Like, so Jess, scale of 1 to 10, what did you think of atmosphere for Puppet Masters of Prince?
I love that you made me go first, Amy. I'm going to give it an 8 because, like I said, there was that, you know, it wasn't all rain and Wuthering Heights and you know, darkness. To me, there was a lot of light where the makers were. And that to me was very not Gothic, which I enjoyed. How about you, Amy?
I'm actually also giving it an 8 because, again, I felt like it was pretty high on the, like, I don't feel like the positive elements of, like, again, the makers community that took away. I felt like there was plenty of dark ambiance between everything else that warranted a high score. So, Lisa, what do you think? How would you rank your book for atmosphere and setting?
I would also give it an 8. I think that there are lots of environments where things are light and lighter, but then there's, you know, the clock tower and kind of what happens up in the clock tower with the Glockenspiel and the inside Wolfspire Hall and inside the keep. Definitely, I would say, our Gothic setting. So, yeah, I think an 8 is appropriate for me.
Okay, wonderful. And then category number 2, the past. Jess, what do you think?
Lisa, I think it's good to know that Amy and I never, I don't think there are a couple of these categories we always differ on. And past and mystery seems that our scores will vary very, very widely. You know, I'm going to kind of go in the middle. I can give it a 5 for the past, just because, you know, in a lot of the previous Gothic novels, we talked about, you know, family history, things like that. There are elements of that there, obviously. But the story was rooted to me in the present, what was happening in Perrow's life right now, rather than you know, history and things like that. Amy, thought.
Actually, I'm actually kind of being you in this case. I'm giving it a 7.
Oh, okay. All right, cool.
Yeah, that's just because, yeah, the majority of the story is in Pirouettes, just the here and now. But in a way, also, we get these references to the past because, again, just by the nature, the biggest thing she has to lie about to people is her origin story. So, again, you know, that keeps coming to haunt her with her splinters. So that's the way the past remains relevant. And then also in how the past affects the present, in the fact that her father passes away because, you know, part of the bargain with creating Pirouette was a few years were cut off of his life. So, like, so that whole sort of bargain with the sort of tree lady dryad, is that what you call it?
Yeah, dryad. Yep.
Yeah, the dryad. So, yeah, so that sort of past also kept poking back. So, yeah, for all those reasons, I gave it a 7. So, cool. Lisa, what did you think? What do you think?
Well, now that I listened to both of your arguments, it's hard for me to choose, but I initially went with the same number that Jess did, which was number 5. I think it's kind of right in the middle, and I was trying to think more in, like, the past of Tavia, which is, you know, more typical fairy tale kingdoms sort of set up, and there's these feudal lords. So I wasn't thinking, when you said the past, quite as much of Pyrrho's past as I was trying to imagine, like, the territory's past and the setting's past, so I would go with a 5.
I think that's why we do this. We all have different interpretations of it.
Yeah. All righty then. Category number 3, the supernatural. Jess.
Well, I'm going to give it a 10. And Lisa, I'll have you know, though, I think the only other times I've given 10 or 8 close was like Dracula, just in this category. But the main character is a wooden girl come to life. So there are other elements of the supernatural with the toy soldiers and the magic and kind of, you know, hearing the trees. I mean, I think there can be an argument to be made if you have your ear close to nature, you those things. But the main character is a supernatural creature. So, and we all know how I love that in a gothic story. So I'm going to give it a 10. How about you?
I also gave it a 10 for all of those obvious reasons, and not just pirouette, but also the sort of talking trees and just everything is sort of alive in that way. And yeah, pretty self-explanatory. You should feel honored, Lisa. She didn't even give Frankenstein anything.
I know. I made a pretty weird argument about Frankenstein. Oh my gosh.
I love it. Well, it feels weird to give my own book a 10 on anything. So I was like thinking I should probably rank it like a 9. But yeah. I think it is probably a 9 or a 10. It's high on the high end there. So why don't you put me down for a 10 as well? Because okay. there is a lot of supernatural happening.
Yes, I think a 10 is great. And again, we're rating it against gothic. So it's, yeah. I think you're good.
Okay.
Alrighty then, category number 4, heroes, heroines, and villains. Like, you know, basically this category is about, like, were there those definite roles in the story? And if they were, like, how nuanced were they and things like that? So, Jess, what do you think?
I'm going to give it a 9. And I don't really have a good reason for not giving it the full 10. I feel like I was invested in the characters, and sometimes in gothic literature you're not. You know, it's more about other elements of the story. The stories that appeal to have a character that, you know, I'm concerned about or that I absolutely loathe. And wasn't a fan of Laszlo. I can imagine he was fun to write, but not a great person, you know. And Pyrrho and Bran, her father, and the Makers all were characters that I cared about and was concerned for them. And I don't always feel that way in a gothic story. So that's why I'm giving. How about you?
Me too. Also 9.
Yep.
And I seem to be matching you guys, because I also went with 9. I think I have the hero. There's a clear heroine. I think the Makers are kind of heroes in their own way and what they're able to contribute. And then we do have a pretty clear villain at the end as well. So, yep, I'm right in line with you guys.
Perfect. Alrighty then. Then final category, category number 5, mystery. Jess, what did you think?
Sorry for the I don't know. I'm going to give it a 7. I just don't know what to give it. I'm thinking, you know, there was mystery as to how the other puppets were coming to life. You know, her origin was a mystery. Amy, I'd like to hear your thoughts, because I'm kind of not really confident in what's going
on. Like, I gave it a 7 because I felt like there was enough mystery, like, because I'm just like, oh, I know Emmett's going to die, and like, but who did it? Like, is it going to be the saboteur itself or someone? And is it fully, my impression was that it wasn't fully, like, confirmed that the young Margrave killed his father. I thought it was just, like, heavily implied that basically he got the saboteur to kill his own dad.
Yeah, that was implied, yep.
Yeah. Alrighty, so I just felt like the nature of, you know, there was some mystery, but I felt like it was more emphasis on supernatural and again, just the whole sense of, oh crap, what have I done? I've created these things and now they're like wreaking havoc on the world. So there were a few mysteries, but I did feel like not too much. And that was okay with me because the other elements were, you know, more emphasized and that was fine. So yeah, I also gave it a 7.
Oh, you guys are so generous. I gave myself a 5 in this category. I think as a writer, building mystery is something that I think I still have a lot of work to do on. And it was the whole point of it. It wasn't to be a mystery, but I think you obviously need elements of mystery to keep your readers, you know, wanting more and wanting to turn the page. So I think that's, it wasn't the main point of the story, but at the same time, I don't know, there's a little bit of it, but I think hopefully I'll get better and better with that with each book. So I gave myself a 5 there.
All right, then. So I've been keeping track and tallying up the marks. So Lisa, you ranked Puppet Master's Apprentice 37 points out of 50.
Mm-hmm.
Jess, you did 39 out of 50.
Right in the middle.
Yep, and I did 41 out of 50.
Awesome.
But It's always fun. I think that Amy and I have talked about this, that we need to like reassess how we've rated all of the novels, just like on their gothicness, you know, just yeah. to, it's just interesting. It'll be interesting.
I think it's so cool that you guys do that. It's really fun to hear your perspective.
Yeah, and we like to do it because it shows, you know, gothic literature, like many other genres, like it's not this one concrete thing. And in fact, and gothic literature is, you know, many ways considered like the sort of umbrella parent category of things like modern horror and paranormal romance and all of those right. sort of things, which emphasize different elements of categories within gothic literature. So
yes, definitely.
Yeah, and Amy and I both have, we've talked to, I think, pretty extensively the past couple episodes about our preferences in gothic. So it's an interesting genre, and I think it definitely branches out a lot, and you kind of can choose your own adventure, your preference, which is wonderful.
Yeah, it's quite versatile, I think is the word you're looking for.
Yes, versatile. Mm. Yes.
Alrighty then. Well, thank you so much, Lisa. Would you like to lead us in our random rereading exercise?
Sure, I would love to. So you want me just to kind of flip through and read like a paragraph?
Yeah, just a random, close your eyes, flip through the book, and then fall in a paragraph and just start reading it.
Okay. All right. Okay. I actually opened to page 66 and there is just one paragraph because it's the end of a chapter. So perfect. I will go ahead and go. That night, I ignore the signaling knock from the other side of the cupboard. I can't bring myself to open it. Bran doubted I could step into my father's shoes and complete the work waiting for me in Curio below. How could someone who belonged from the moment he first squalled in his mother's arms know how it feels to come from something rather than someone? How could he understand this impossible chasm between what I am and how I came to be? The distance between us wraps around me like the cold weight of a dead man's embrace. And that's the end of the chapter.
Yeah, that's the end of chapter 6.
Yeah, chapter 6. Yep.
So, yeah, is this after he saw her splinter in the woods?
I think it is.
Yeah, so, yeah, again, going to back to what I said about, like, you know, not really thinking fully through about, like, you know, she can't lie ever, and therefore she cannot have super close relationships, and now she's feeling mm-hmm. she has to push Bran away because there's no way he'll be able to empathize and understand, you know, about where she comes from, and not just maybe just from a personal like standpoint of can he truly get it, but also it's not just, you know, will he personally accept her or not and have a relationship with her, like it's illegal, she cannot get have right. this information.
Right, it's dangerous for him to even know that that's how she was made, that she's not human or not in the same way that everyone else is. So yeah,
I think that the cupboard, I love those scenes because I'm a romantic at heart, love the gothic and I love some romance. So I just, that always made me warm my heart with those scenes. I thought those were very sweet.
Thank you. I know, I always as a kid, I wanted to have like a room with like a cool loft or like up in a garret or... So the idea of having like this cool cupboard in your bedroom and then finding it opens to your neighbor's house is kind of just a cool little element that it was really fun to write.
And I'm sure a lot of old school, like, you know, buildings and shops were made that way.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Having been in like in Anne Frank's house, like, you know, where they hid, and it's like all those old buildings just have like crazy cupboards and false walls and, you know, places to hide things or people. And so that always is a fun element to explore.
Alrighty then. And that concludes this week's episode with The Puppet Master's Apprentice. Thank you so, so much, Lisa, for joining us, you know, in talking about the gothic leanings that you never intended, but they're still so fabulous.
Thank you so much, Amy, and thank you, Jess. Your questions have been so fantastic. It's just been great to chat with you, and I just really appreciate you guys reading the book and just being willing to talk about it with me. This has been so, so fun. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
thank
you. Yes, and then tune in next time, and Jess and I will be going back to the 18th century, The Mysteries of Udolpho by Anne Radcliffe.
Yes, she is a very descriptive lady, Miss Anne Radcliffe.
It's 700 pages.
It is a lot of pages.
Alrighty, guys, that is that. Tune in next time. Bye.